Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the fallout that occurred all day yesterday from the news that was announced during our program on Monday that Elon Musk had acquired a 9.2% stake in Twitter, making him the largest single shareholder in Twitter. And also in the provocative form that Elon Musk often uses, took to Twitter to suggest
he owns it now.
Well, he doesn't own it, but Twitter, you know, Twitter is a platform that's supposed to be about free speech, is living up to its values, making insinuations that were cheered by many, but many fewer Twitter employees and those blue check mafia members on Twitter, cheered by those who believe in a free marketplace of ideas and denounced or at least concerns expressed by those who believe that free speech so long as you agree with me. What do you think of Musk's move to rather than build his own social media platform a la what Trump is attempting to do, just buy somebody else's infrastructure and audience? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro, text line. There's some who are suggesting in a Twitter that Musk will be the salvation of free speech in the West. I think it's a little bit too soon to make that call, but Musk's pronouncements on social media, some of the positions that he's taken, certainly are in a positive direction towards free speech and a open marketplace of ideas.
Yeah, because he tweeted out, free speech is essential to a functioning democracy. Do you believe Twitter rigorously adheres to this principle? 29.6% said yes. No, 70.4%.
Right, but among the no that said 70, well, among the 29% that said yes, you know, that's a lot of people who, again, take the position that free speech is speech that by somebody who agrees with me. Because speech by somebody who disagrees with me is, by definition, hate speech. And that should be regulated. And this is, if not banished from the kingdom altogether. It's going to be interesting. I mean, it's almost like if Musk were to make a play here, and in the filing he made with the SEC that's required, he filed a 13G report, which is a filing reserved for passive investors. Shareholders, this is a Wall Street Journal reporting, shareholders typically include a certification that says they didn't acquire the securities to change or influence control of the company that issued them. Mr. Musk, however, did not include such a statement on the form. Instead, he simply wrote not applicable. So whether that generates some follow-up inquiry by the SEC, who Musk has a bit of history with, or not, we'll see. But it is sort of interesting, and he's a cagey guy, obviously. He wouldn't be the richest man in the world if he wasn't. So will he be a passive investor, and this is to make money and to, you know, virtue signal about free speech, or at least to try to be an enforcer on premises that the company knows if they go too far afield when it comes to, you know, things like banning conservatives and shadow banning people with whom they disagree, even when their opinions are perfectly within the bounds of civil discourse.
And flagging stories like the Hunter Biden story from the New York Post.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I mean, things like that.
Suppressing stories. Exactly. Yeah, taking down the one of the oldest newspapers in the country for a time because you were trying to protect your candidate for president.
Yeah.
Then Musk is sort of on site to perhaps take a more aggressive posture than he is out of the gate. So that in itself is a service. But whether he takes that to the next level to try to install new leadership in the company to try to create a new corporate culture more consistent with the original promise of Twitter, we have yet to see.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Our text line's also open. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Did you partake in his poll? Because he did say, you know, he said the consequences of this poll will be important, so please vote carefully.
That was the Twitter CEO who responded to the poll whether or not Twitter should have an edit function. That was the Twitter CEO responding to the question that Musk posed, saying, please consider carefully because the answers will have implications, which is sort of a hostile posture for the CEO to take against the
shareholder,
largest shareholder in the company. But that speaks to the corporate culture at Twitter. And this is the guy who replaced Jack Dorsey after he went to permanently live in a shire with some of these other software engineers who are leaving Twitter, according to some of the posts that have been compiled by Andy Ngo online and some that are just being shared. One, my current sentiment, stock is up, yay, but what about our company culture? Another, looks like I picked a good week to be off. Twitter software engineer posted a video named Ashna Guliani, posted a video of a crying woman to show how upset she is over Musk being the largest shareholder of the company. Because, of course, stock price was up 25%, so that's all good news for their 401ks. But, of course, they don't like the free speech posture of an Elon Musk. And we know this not just because of what they posted yesterday. We know this because of what they've done and because of what they said in an unguarded moments, like when James O'Keefe a couple years ago now in Project Veritas did one of their guerrilla reporting operations, and they got Twitter software engineers to talk about how they shadow ban and how they regulate content and how they try to marginalize conservative voices on the platform. And this gave rise to Parler, which then gave rise to the response from big tech to effectively deplatform Parler. And so the additional development we could see if Elon Musk does take an aggressive posture and really presses Twitter for that change in corporate culture we were describing, then do you see Elon Musk versus big tech? Is it Elon Musk versus Tim Cook, for example, you know, Apple, which took the lead in deplatforming Parler? It could be very interesting. So I'm not saying that, you know, Elon Musk may not be our Batman against big tech here. I think it just remains to be seen, because if he does rile the blue check mafia on Twitter, not to mention all the geeks that work at Twitter that were groomed from pre-K through post-secondary at many of whom at elite universities and completely indoctrinated politically. If they all revolt against Elon Musk, then do you have a clash of the titans in big tech? That would be an interesting development. Kip in Stillman Valley.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, I'm just wondering if this might be going in some kind of planning on Elon's with all the satellites that he has up with, like, isn't it supposed to be like a neutral kind of satellite systems that are up there to help with broadband and getting more of a freer way to run servers and stuff than the current, the people that want to control free speech? Is there any way that maybe all this might be coming together with his, you know, SpaceX and I don't know what they call their thing for the, like, an internet more of a way so the people that have control of that, I'm lost in the big tech stuff because I'm not a techie. But
yeah, thanks for the call, Kip. You know, is this a way for him to, you know, decentralize control of the internet? Perhaps in part. I mean, if one way to decentralize control is to allow people to have their say and to not take a ideological posture with respect to regulating content, or certainly take a much lighter touch, you know, constructing algorithms that root out profanity but don't root out disagreement. You know, remember here, we're talking about Twitter, by the way. This is a lot of this is elites talking to elites, at least those with followings, which is why this is so interesting. Only about 1 in 5 U.S. adults use Twitter.
Really?
According to data that was out earlier this year. So, I mean, that's still a big number, and it's a big business. I get it. But, you know, 80% don't. And probably even a greater percentage don't use it frequently, don't have but a handful of followers and so forth. So they don't have, you know, cultural sway, if you will, not part of the blue check mafia, very small number of people. But that's why it makes it so much more interesting, because these are people inside various bubbles and then sort of one big bubble. Media, academics, celebrities, you know, those sorts of individuals. And Elon Musk is, as I said, the Batman, because he's sort of the positioning himself, at least, as sort of the people's champion against these big tech elites who have demonstrated serious authoritarian impulses. So, you know, he's potentially has a much bigger audience, even if they're not tweeting on a daily basis, than does big tech. And so that's why any clash that would involve an Elon Musk versus the, you know, Apple, Google, Facebook mafia would be really interesting just to see that play out. Elon Musk versus Fang, if you will. Jim, Crown Point.
I think Elon Musk would be a great umpire for the site. I think there's more going on behind the scenes. He's a 10% owner. I think he is influencing other high shareholders. And 20% of the population is controlling 80%. So I think it's crucial that we turn that around to go forward.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, right, exactly. 20% is exercising an inordinate amount of control over the exchange of ideas in what is supposed to be a free society. That's true. And to the extent that Elon Musk can dilute their power, and frankly his own in the process, is the extent that he will be a champion for free speech and a move back towards Western civilization. So we'll see.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One more remark on Elon Musk and Twitter before we turn our attention to Triple Threat, and that is, I think one of the first things he could do now that he's installed as the largest shareholder of Twitter.
Yeah, what?
Call for a prisoner release. Call for Twitter to return all those they gulagged illegitimately. Let's make a list so Elon Musk can have a ready-made list for that he can publicize So we'll take your calls on that all morning. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I know someone. I want President Trump back on Twitter.
Okay. That's an obvious one. All right,
yeah.
Fine.
That's low-hanging fruit. But
it's low-hanging fruit, but it's a legitimate one. Former president, yeah, should probably not be banned. I'll add.
Yeah.
Alex Berenson.
Oh, God. Yes, bingo.
Yeah.
You win the prize.
Alex Berenson.
Unbelievable.
That would be a good start. It's hard to remember all the people that are banned because out of sight, out of mind. But I just like the idea of Elon Musk having specifics to publicize and put pressure on Twitter from even a passive investor's position to see if he can start to move the corporate culture. Before he has to take more aggressive action, if he's so inclined. So anyway, just a thought. Over the weekend at Anti-Violence Youth Summit at Washington Libraries, we discussed yesterday Triple Threat and her police toady, David Brown, were at the Washington Library talking about how to reduce the violence in the city because more than half the carjackings are committed by juveniles and so on and so forth. And Triple Threat said the problem in Chicago is there are too many unloved kids, which, of course, prompts the question, OK, what is Mayor Big Love going to do to increase the love, to increase the peace?
And so I asked your question yesterday, Dan.
You mentioned yesterday at a youth summit that juvenile carjackers feel unloved. So what is the city's role in providing love to the unloved kids committing violent crimes?
Well, I said a number of things, one of which was about love. But let me make sure that the context is set.
So she went on, word salad. But this is the bottom line. OK, this is how the city is going to provide love to the children who are carjacking.
This is a classic circumstance where it takes a village. And, of course, love has got to be a part of it. Love, support,
love.
Tough love, whatever it takes to turn around the lives of these young people, to hold them accountable, but also make them accountable to themselves. And that's the challenge.
312-64.
What does that mean?
It was all about love. She has no idea. She just said it because they're desperate right now. They have no other answers.
Well, that's not an answer.
What specifically
are you going to do in furtherance of loving the unloved? We need to do whatever it takes, and we need to do it every day, including to, she sounds like Kamala Harris. What does that mean? You had a specific diagnosis, so your specific response is whatever it takes? Well, what kind of plan is that?
Well, she did point out an 11-year-old kid who was a carjacking leader, believe it or not, been arrested more times than they could count. And he recruited other people. Here's a story about this 11-year-old whose name they're not using.
Not only has he not missed a day of school, he's got a mentor who is looking out for him every single day, and he recently made the honor roll. That's a remarkable turnaround. And the lesson for me is, if we reach these kids and we provide them with the right level of supports, if we make sure that they understand the consequences of their actions and how them pulling a gun on somebody completely turn around someone's life and victimizes them, but we provide them with supports to get them back on track, then we can truly save hearts and minds in this city.
I mean, what I wanted to ask her was, so if somebody's carjacking me, do I turn around and tell them, yeah, have my car, and I want you to know that I love you. You are loved.
The story of the 11-year-old. Mm-hmm. What's the context of that?
Remember the kid? He was skipping. I don't know if you saw the video. It was one carjacking that was caught on somebody's Ring camera, and he was skipping up to the lady with a gun. And so this one kid, they after multiple carjackings and being a ringleader, they put him in a different school. They gave him a mentor, and they showed him love. And
I don't buy that story for a second. First of all, was there punishment for the carjackings, particularly if he was a ringleader?
Didn't sound like it. Didn't spend any time
in
juvie.
If it's a turnaround story that we can scale, then give me all the details. so that we make it programmatic. No, I don't buy it. I don't buy it. And these apocryphal anecdotes that politicians offer off the cuff because they have no real ideas on the topic, nothing really to offer except their customary cant, should be challenged.
I mean,
that's a bunch of nonsense.
I know.
What she was saying, the 11-year-old, now he's an honor student. Yeah, I know. That's become a punchline. Everybody is an honor student in waiting, or was turning their life around before they shot up a place or stole somebody's car. Spare me. Here's what happened. Some kid did bad, and then we put him in a new school and got him a mentor, and now he's an honor student. I don't think so. I don't think it's quite that linear. And don't give me a, well, we can't tell you the details because he's an 11-year-old. If you want to tell me the story, you want to say that this is a model that we can replicate and scale, then give me the details. Spare me.
I mean, they actually had a press conference yesterday, Dan, to announce the biggest gun buyback in history. I'm like, I could have ripped a script that I wrote at Channel 5 from 1996 and used that script.
Of course.
And local businesses are coming forward to donate $1 million, each kid, if they hand in a gun, is going to get about $100. Well, if I really needed $100, I can go get a COVID shot or a booster.
Those businesses, is there a list of those businesses?
Oh, yeah. One is BMO Harris, my bank.
Yeah.
And what that, I got, first of all, I'm like, why is my bank guy here? Because I've been at BMO Harris for, you know, since 1996. Listen to what he said. You get David Casper. BMO Financial Services.
This has been an awful couple of years for all of us in many ways. And the police department and all of you in the police department have gone through real hell in many ways. I don't pretend to speak for the entire business community, but I think I do in thanking you. Thanking you. If I owned a billboard company, I would put up on the billboard. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, fine. Thank the police participating that way. You're trying to
give
get more. You're trying to get more city business there, Mr. Casper. Is that it?
Of course he is.
You're using this as a PR stunt to profile to raise the profile of BMO Harris. Not that that needs much profile raising, but okay. I mean, you understand. You would be better, and the city would be better served if you took whatever portion of the $1 million. They're donating, or are they donating the whole thing?
No, they're donating a portion of the $1 million.
Okay, whatever portion, and light it on fire in front of the political ruling class and say, this is the dumbest idea that we continue repeating. Why do we in Chicago have a penchant for repeating the dumbest ideas? To make ourselves feel good? Well, I'm not interested in making myself feel good. I'm interested in doing something that is productive in furtherance of public safety. And as a business leader, and you're not, Mr. Casper. I don't care how big the bank is you work for. You're not a leader, because a leader wouldn't go along with a scam like that.
Scam. I'm thinking I want to leave BMO Harris.
$100 to give to turn in your guns, right? So let me think. I can go get $100 from Mr. Casper at BMO Harris, or I can use this gun to steal the car or to protect the drug turf that I had originally envisioned its usage. And that is my daily stock and trade. That's how I make money. That's how I survive. That's how I stay alive. I mean, does it ever get any better with this electorate? Is this not the dumbest urban electorate in the country, Chicago? Is this not the dumbest, most cowardly business leaders, in quotation mark, business leadership class, elite class in the country? How pathetic. You lie to yourself in public and you think no one notices. And I guess most people don't. Oh, that's nice what BMO Harris is doing. I think I'm going to go in and open a demand deposit account. What the hell?
I know. And then they also want you to get a security camera, and they'll give you a rebate if you go buy one, and then sign up your security camera to link to CPD. And then they tell you, but you'll still will need your consent in order to use it. No, you won't. Just if you go to cityofchicago.org/camera security, you can sign up your personal security camera that's linked to them so they could get it at any time. You know, to help to fight crime, because we're in this together, Dan. We're all in. Kept hearing that yesterday, too.
A bankrupt city is going to reimburse residents and businesses for security cameras and GPS mm-hmm. trackers.
Yeah. $50 per device.
So we turn the city over to the barbarians. I mean, some of whom are in office. We've turned them over to barbarians in elective office who then turn them over to barbarians at the street level. And the make good is reimbursement for security cameras and GPS trackers.
$225 per camera. So if you have, you know, two cameras, they'll give you $450 to have a camera that they can have access to help fight crime because they're that desperate.
They're not that desperate. Stop saying they're desperate. There's nothing desperate about this. This is a scam. They're scam artists. We're desperate to do something. No, they're not. You know how I know they're not? Because that's what they say. And whatever they say should be immediately dismissed. Whether it's some hack senior VP from BMO Harris or the politicians he's standing with. Desperate to do something. We'll do anything. Whatever it takes. No, you won't. You won't do whatever it takes. You won't do the one thing that it does take. You won't enforce the law. You won't back the police. You won't do the basics. We'll do everything and anything other than what makes sense. That's Chicago writ large. Whatever it takes. We're desperate to do something. No, you're not. I mean, if you want to be lied to, then just consume whatever you're spoon-fed from the C-suite and media and political ruling class in Chicago. If you want to just, gorge yourself on the beautiful lies they tell, the same ones they've been telling for 50 years, you go ahead. I don't want to be a party to it. And if you can't call out these individuals, again, across all of these coalition partners, the BGA, I mean, how many times do I have to say it? The Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce, the Michigan Avenue Association.
Yeah, they had the Lakeview East Chamber of Commerce. They're going to raise money for the gun buyback.
Whatever.
Blah, blah, blah.
Keep going. The Economic Club, the City Club, rent seekers and government parasites that lunch at Maggiano's.
Well, and Father Flager
talk
was there
to each other.
Saying the same bull jive line.
Race hustlers like Father Flager.
Yeah,
those who underwrite race hustlers like all those C-suite execs. Melody Hobson, John Rogers, the Obama crew. Go ahead. Lie to yourself. You don't want to call them out? You want to continue listening to the same approach, non-approach, to the endemic violence, maleducation, economic deprivation? You go ahead. You go ahead and buy the gun buyback program and the Marshall Plan for the West Side and the South Side. And all of the other press releases that, as Amy said, have been dusted off administration after administration to run the same game. Go ahead.
And the same actors are saying the same things.
A lot of the same people. And if not, it's new people in the same institutions.
I mean, I really want to play this Father Flager bite because I swear to God he said the same thing to me in 1996.
But I absolutely believe that the security cameras and the turn-ins of getting guns off the street are an important and valuable part to make our city safer.
Matt in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, I love your passion. I need a couple things. Nobody wants to talk about the root of all this evil is the destruction of the family and the welfare state. Take the father out of the family, you break it down. And multiple, you know, women having multiple children with multiple men is a result of welfare, and it's proven time and time again. But they, of course, don't want to talk about that. And then secondly, regarding Flager, I see him occasionally down in Evergreen Park. He goes to a bakery down there, and I had a laugh. I told him what a clown he is. He comes in with a with an army jacket on with peace signs all over it. Oh, and I noticed a really nice truck out in the parking lot. You know, this is allegedly a Catholic priest, right? Beautiful truck out there. It's a brand-new Chevy Tahoe, about an $80,000 vehicle. I walk in, Flager, see Flager. I walk out with Flager. I told him he's a clown as he's getting into that $80,000 Tahoe. He's a scam artist. That's all he is. Have a good day, folks.
Thanks for the comment. Yeah, paid for by the from the donations of Southside Black folks, largely poor Southside Black folks at St. Sabina. Of course he is. And we love it. And so does the Chicago Press Corps. And that's why we love it, because Chicago Press Corps tells us to. Because we're such deep thinkers in Chicago. We're such common sense, big shoulders type people, aren't we? Tony Southside.
Amy Lamb, Professor Prof. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, listen. Lightfoot said something in that clip you played where that 11-year-old boy pulled out a gun. That only takes 1 second. Remember KBJ was saying 15 seconds shouldn't ruin a life? You know, put that all together and figure that one out. That's all I need to say, man.
All right, Tony. But he wasn't 26 years old, so according to Tim Evans, he's not doesn't know right from wrong.
Right.
Nobody does under the age of 26. Jeff in Lincolnshire.
Good morning. I wanted to make a point about the earlier comment where the boy was seen skipping down the street on his way to the carjacking. Was he singing the song Singing in the Rain?
Yeah, right. Malcolm McDowell and the Oogs. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Clockwork Orange. That's a good description of Chicago as well.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Sergey Karaganov is a former presidential advisor to both Boris Yeltsin and Vlad Putin. He did an interview in an outlet called New Statesman about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, what Russia wants, what it must have. He is considered a hawk. He very much takes the position that the West shouldn't be surprised. We've been saying for 25 years that if NATO expands toward Russia, there are red lines that cannot be crossed or there will be war. And so here we are. He says to the question, what's the final goal for the Kremlin at this point? What would be considered a successful outcome for the invasion? The answer, I don't know what the outcome of this war will be, but I think it will involve the partition of Ukraine one way or another. Hopefully there will still be something called Ukraine left at the end, but Russia cannot afford to lose, in quotation marks, so we need a kind of victory. And if there's a sense that we are losing the war, then I think there's a definite possibility for escalation. This war is a kind of proxy war between the West and the rest, Russia being, as it has been in history, the pinnacle of the rest. Well, I don't know about that. For a future world order. This is his view, though. The stakes of the Russian elite are very high. For them, it's an existential war. That's a big statement if Mr. Karaganov is right. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Samir Puri, who's a former ceasefire observer in East Ukraine. He's also author of The Shadows of Empire, which was published last year. Samir, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be with you.
You know, based on your experience in country and thus dealing with the Russians, how do you react to what that former Putin presidential advisor had to say?
It's really striking, isn't it, to think about the possibility that the end of this war could be a divided Ukraine, properly bisected between a part that the Russian military refuses to leave. And as you mentioned, I was observing a ceasefire. This was in the first round of the Russia-Ukraine war, 2014, when it began. Listeners will probably remember when Crimea was was annexed, and MH17, that Malaysian airline, was shot down. And certainly it's been bubbling away since then at quite a low intensity. And then it's really, really, the war is at such a large scale now. But it's amazing that to me that the war was bubbling away for the 8 years before it exploded in the way that it did in February. Not without people noticing, but I guess with people forgetting. But I think, you know, the article you were reading, it shows that a lot of the elites in Russia, the people around Putin, they never forgot. And they never dropped that ambition that they've had, which is, we're the former imperial master. We want the dominating stake in Ukraine. So the question we've now got is what they'll settle for, especially because their war isn't going so well on the ground.
Well, what will Putin settle for?
Right. Well, this is where the pressure that he's being put under by the US, by my country, the UK, that's really important, not only the sanctions, but also the support being provided to the Ukrainian armed forces. So he's a gambler, Putin, and he'll settle for what he can get away with. And at the moment, it looks like he can get away with some territory in the east of Ukraine, some territory in the south of Ukraine that he holds. But I think the big question now is whether the Ukrainian armed forces, they're going to be a bit motivated by the fact they've retaken areas around the capital, Kyiv, whether they go on the counterattack, and then Putin will have no choice but to settle for something less. But that's really where we are. It's really uncertain now as to whether the Russians will be able to keep hold of the east and south of Ukraine, or whether they can take more territory, or whether that territory will be taken away from them.
Well, it seems that Putin is intent, given his turning Mariupol into a parking lot, making that a land bridge between Crimea and eastern Ukraine. Seems like that's at minimum what he wants. I don't know. That's just, you know, what I'm understanding from the experts that I'm reading, at minimum. And also, though, now going back to what this former Putin advisor had to say, you know, if the war isn't going so well, and if he doesn't feel like he is able to achieve or hold the minimum required to present victory in his terms, then the fear of escalation, then it actually could get worse. He could get more aggressive. Then you're talking about potentially, as we've been talking about now for a couple of weeks, the prospect of chemical weapons or even regional nuclear weapons. And, you know, is the West prepared for that? And then one more layer of this, and then your response too. You know, how are the sanctions impacting his ability to prosecute this invasion? It doesn't seem like they're working. I mean, it's very splashy when you take a $90 million yacht away from some oligarch, but big deal. The ruble has now rebounded in terms of its rate of exchange with the dollar to where it was pre-invasion.
Yeah. Yeah, like you say, there are so many layers to this. There's so many angles you can approach it from. And you've picked out a couple of really important ones there with the sanctions and the chemical weapons escalation. Just taking the sanctions first, it's really strange, isn't it? Because, you know, Putin isn't waging this war for profit. It's not like Ukraine's got oil fields or anything like that. You know, it produces a lot of grain and it produces lots of, you know, engineering products. It's a war of ideology for Putin, and that's probably why he's been undeterrable at this point. And the other side is, of course, the economic relationship with China that Russia has. That's something that's changed a lot in the last 10 years, is that, you know, the Russians and the Chinese have become much closer. But it's not only China. I think Russia will be looking to trade with China. Hopefully it will trade with Iran. It has a big arms and weapons trading relationship with India, something that I think is not maybe appreciated enough. And the Indians are sticking with it. Senior Indian military officers I've spoken to and heard from, one of whom actually likened it to the way the US sticks with its defense relationship with Israel through thick and thin, controversies or not. Make of that what you will. That's just what I heard. That's not my view personally. And basically they're saying, well, you can criticize us, India, but we're still going to buy Russian arms because that's what our armed forces are built on. But your first point about the chemical weapons, I mean, no one knows, do they? No one knows the lengths to which Putin would move if he's desperate. But he does have a conundrum, which is he wants to occupy, maybe govern these spaces. And so, yes, Mariupol, like you say, has been, you know, turned into a parking lot. And yes, you know, a nice town. I really feel for Ukrainians, having lived in the east. And You know, I'm seeing cities I lived in or visited or worked in being bombed. Kharkiv being another one that was hit very early on in the conflict. I had a lovely time there, spending a week when I was doing my work there. But we've got to remember that the Russian separatists have occupied parts of Donetsk and Luhansk for 8 years now. They've got some administrative structures, and there are some sort of things that the Russians could probably extend and roll out a little bit further. I think there's a bit of a limit to how much they can, how much damage they can bring. Obviously not in Mariupol, but to turn something into a radiation zone or to turn something into something that's been affected by chemical weapons, I still think we won't see that. But I'm saying that more from hope than I am from knowing anything more than you do.
Yeah.
And with those mass civilian casualties, I mean, the images are almost too gruesome to bear. And the Russian people are being told that those are staged, that those are actors.
Yeah. And you know, that's the thing is, where we're seeing those are specific places where the Russian advance was halted in its approach to the capital, Kiev. The names are now familiar. Bucha, Hostomel Airport, the Russians tried to seize with their airborne forces in the first hours of the invasion. Irpin and cities like this, all to the northwest. They're suburban, outer-reach cities to the capital. So you can imagine that that means you're just a few miles drive away from the center of town. And it looks like the Russians have gotten stopped there. It looks like they've gotten frustrated. It looks like there's no discipline. And it also looks like the narrative that Putin used, this horrible narrative, this bizarre narrative that there's denazification to take place in Ukraine. It's probably trickled down into through the leadership down to the rank and file, and you're dehumanizing not only the Ukrainian government, but the Ukrainian people, and that's how these sorts of war crimes start to happen. But it's awful, and let's hope that we don't see something similar to that in the East, but there's every possibility that something similar to what we've seen around Kiev could now start to happen in the East.
Yeah, that's a good point about the propaganda used to dehumanize your enemy. Just going back to that Putin advisor, though, you know, he's trying to crawl in the minds of these people. Do you think that we in the West, the leadership of the United States and Britain, Western Europe, have been too Pollyannish about people like Putin for too long, and now, frankly, too Pollyannish about President Xi in China, which presents much more of a long-term threat to Western civilization than does Putin. But I digress. We think that they want the same things that we want. And that Russian advisor saying, we think it's the West and the rest, and Russia's at the pinnacle of the rest. He went on in that interview to say, you know, he has long believed that the West's dominance, global dominance, is over. The West period, the period of American reign and Western reign is over. And this is the entree to a new period where it's Russia and maybe Russia and China that are the dominant powers. This is their thinking. And if you don't understand what your opponent is thinking, then you don't get a real handle on his designs, and then you put yourself in a position like the West has put itself in with Putin.
Yeah, I like the way you expressed that, because this invasion is happening at a really interesting moment in history. And actually, after my year in Ukraine, I left government service and doing that sort of, you know, war zone work, and I wrote this book, The Shadows of Empire, which actually wrestles with the question that the idea of empire is actually alive and kicking in different parts of the world, and definitely Russia, definitely China. But, you know, if you're coming from the USA, then the idea of empire, well, you know, kicked out the British a long time ago, and it's sort of the world has moved on. Well, that idea of empire hasn't died away. And that's why you've got a situation like Russia and Ukraine, where you've got a sense of hierarchy being felt by the guys in Moscow who are in power in the Kremlin. And they call Ukraine Little Rus', which is an allusion to something that was existed in history, in which Ukraine was very much subservient. You mentioned China. There is something of an analogy with what's happening with Taiwan, although it's not exactly the same in Taiwan. Its population is half the size. It's separated by water. But I'll summarize it like this, because I think this is quite a neat way of thinking about it. So all I've known in my lifetime is U.S. dominance around the world. All I've known is that my country, the UK, is part of NATO. We're allied with the US. And, you know, there's a certain confidence that comes with that. But I would put the USA as having transformed from the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world to the disputed heavyweight champion of the world. USA is still a predominance of military power, of economic power, and the rest of it. We all know the score. But it hasn't faced rivals who are sort of nipping away at its ankles and actually potentially, you know, going to carve out different parts of the world for their own sort of civilizational visions for a very long time, certainly not in my lifetime. And I think this is a very different world that we're having to think about how to navigate and thinking about how to coexist with countries like China and, dare I say, with Russia. I know we might be really, really upset, angry and horrified and disgusted by what Vladimir Putin has done, but there's every possibility the guy stays in power for another 5, 7, 10 years. He's turning 70 this year, but who knows? Maybe he will stay in power. Then we have to still live in a world with someone like him. And I think that's going to take a fresh thinking that looks back to history. So we're looking back to look forward to work out what's happening and maybe how to navigate, you know, what's happening right now.
He is Samir Puri. He is a senior fellow in hybrid warfare and urban security at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He was a ceasefire observer in eastern Ukraine back in 2014 after Russia took Crimea. He's also the author of The Shadows of Empire. Samir Puri, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Real pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
I like Cassidy Campbell and also Alex Primetime Stein because they're more prolific than the Party Bros. I love the Party Bros.
Well, Party Bros have been gone for a while. I think COVID scared them away.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But I mean, Cassidy Campbell, a.k.a. Marty Epstein, a.k.a. whoever he's pretending to be, most recently, and Primetime Stein, they're hitting all these city council meetings in Dallas, in the Texas area, larger Dallas area. Cassidy Campbell, a.k.a. Marty Epstein, a.k.a. I don't know who he's pretending to be at the Rockwall, Texas city council meeting, but he's always au courant, and this time tackling the topic of LGBTQIA rights.
And he has a pink hat on.
Hi, I'm Marty Epstein, and to start off, you may be wondering, am I gay? No, I am not gay. I'm metrosexual and a proud ally of the LGBTQ community, and I believe in science. Three things I love are minorities, gay men, and gay minorities. So many people say that they support the gay community and minorities. Meanwhile, they fail to take any action. However, I myself am very proactive and always prepped. Here are some ways that you can show support for the gay community. Go to gay bars so you can interact. He's laughing. And get to know the gay community. Contract HIV so you can have an understanding of where they are coming from. Listen to Elton John or Queen in the car and Lil Nas X as a last resort if those other two are not available. The reason for this is that it is important to diversify where the music comes from and support our gay musicians. 4, have drag queen story time in the classrooms. Teach kids about the gay community with fun things like gay storytelling. 5, put a pride flag in front of your home. Let the neighborhood know where you stand, because being neutral is not enough. You need to be an ally. If my whole neighborhood didn't know my stance on gay pride, I would not be able to sleep at night. Also, I recommend putting up a Black Lives Matter flag so the neighborhood knows you support gay black lives, because it's not enough to just support gay lives. The last thing I would ever need is for anybody to think that I was either homophobic or racist. And lastly, eat Skittles every morning so that you can taste the rainbow. Last Friday, I went to a gay bar in my area to show my support and purposely contracted HIV so I could show our gay allies that they are not alone in this fight for democracy. When I finally got home, I told my wife that I contracted HIV, and she asked me if I was okay. And I said, honey, I've never been better in my life. Every NFL Sunday.
Wow.
And then he does the George Floyd, genuflecting at the end for George Floyd, in honor of George Floyd.
He was wearing a Hillary 2016 t-shirt, I believe, and a pink hat.
I just love the, you know, emotional wreck that he presents with his commentary, that he's always on the verge of tears. It's, I mean, I like the Prime Einstein rapping, but I don't know, that just, that satire strikes me as more pitch perfect for the left. So that's Cassidy Campbell's latest.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Do we have a velvet civil war going on in the United States? The reference is to, of course, the Czech Revolution that ended 40 years of communist rule and installed Václav Havel as the president of the Czech Republic. And it was a nonviolent transition of power. And what I think we're seeing happening in America is a nonviolent transition of power away from big states that are dominated by big urban centers to states that are not. The transition of power is occurring not at the governmental level, it's occurring at the citizen level through migration. Recent 1950 census data, updated 1950 census data that was released this week, actually.
Yeah.
You know, 72-year lag period, which is customary for government.
They're on it.
No, but comparing 50 to 2020.
Okay, what did we...
The nation's 10 largest cities in 1950, of those 10 largest cities, only New York and L.A. went on to have larger populations in 2020. So the other eight, including Chicago, saw their populations fall in the following seven decades. Now, they maybe fall from the city proper into the outlying suburban areas, and thus the explosion of suburban areas around some of these big cities, including Chicago. However, over the course, you can look at that over the course of 70 years, but now you look at what's happening in those states, generally speaking, and the states where these 10 largest cities are located are losing population at the state level because those states have rotted from the big city out. And now a large share of its residents want out to other places. Thus, you see, per the 2020 census, places like New York and California and Illinois losing congressional seats, and places like Texas and Tennessee and Florida gaining congressional seats. Something else, too. It's migratory pattern, but it begets something. Two Americas. Red and blue.
Yeah. It's a real thing.
This is an interesting data point. This story, New York Times story, new laws move blue and red states further apart. Propagandist over at The Gray Lady. As Republican activists aggressively pursue conservative social policies in state legislatures across the country, liberal states are taking defensive actions. Mm-hmm. And we see this playing out right now with the parental rights legislation in Florida, which we'll get to in a second again. But this data point. The flurry of action is intensifying already marked differences between life in liberal and conservative-led parts of the country, and it's a sign of the consequences when state governments are controlled increasingly by single parties. Control of legislative chambers is split between parties now in only two states, Minnesota and Virginia, compared with 15 states where they had split legislative chambers 30 years ago. So migratory patterns beget electoral patterns because people are moving not so much based on weather, although that's an aspect of it.
No, they're moving on based on freedoms.
Well, they're based on policy, based on quality of life.
I mean, eventually I'm going to end up in a red state because I never want to come back, because it's not if it's when the next thing hits or what they determine might be a pandemic and they're going to lock it all down again, and I'm not going to participate in that. I'm done. See, I gave them everything I could give, and I'm absolutely spent.
Well, see if this letter resonates with you and the listening audience. We got this yesterday from a listener who moved in February from Illinois to Tennessee. Here is our consolidated list about why we left Illinois and relocated to Tennessee. In Tennessee, individual liberties are respected. The governor is not a dictator. And if I were to be needed, the state house and state senate would act as a, if it were to be needed, I should say, the state house and state senate would act as a check on oppressive executive dictates, per your point about Jelly Belly and the lack of a general assembly in Illinois. In Illinois, too many units of government are vying with each other to steal the value of your home. Yes, well.
You've been saying that for years.
Yeah, property taxes. Other taxes are lower in Tennessee as well, gas, sales. And while it does not affect us, there's no estate tax either. Pretty much across the board, taxes are lower. Police are respected. Crime is lower. The state isn't beholden to government unions and the high cost they bring. Right, Illinois, as I've also said for decades now, Illinois is a suicide pact between state government and the public sector unions, both parties. Chicago, its collar counties, and other large cities control the state, this listener writes. We don't understand how most liberals can complain about how things are and continue to vote for the same party, people, and policies.
Yet they do.
Yet they do. And thus, so the benefits of Tennessee, from this listener's perspective, it's good to be around so many conservative thinkers who are positive about their lives and future. In Illinois, we all seem to be so bleak. We lived near O'Hare. It's much quieter here, and the city, the air is less polluted. Both our boys relocated to other states well before we did. If their families were in Illinois, it would have made it much more difficult. It's easy to get a great job down here. What they lose, they say, is what you would expect, the things that keep people here. Lifelong friends, neighbors, they had good relationships. They lived in the near western burbs.
I'm sure they missed the restaurants. And
the guy who wrote us was involved in his community, served on the village's plan commission. They raised their children, owned three homes in the town.
Wow.
So, I mean, they, you know, built a life here, and that's not easy to walk away from. There's a lot of great memories. But there's a great life to be had, a greater life, a better life to be had, down in Tennessee. And that's a decision that millions of Americans and hundreds of thousands of Illinoisans are making every year. So you tell me, and frankly, I prefer this. I mean, this is the founder's great vision of the 50 laboratories of democracy and decentralizing power away from a central government to the states and localities. But, you know, the need for there's no need for a civil war, really. And thankfully, I'm certainly not promoting one because of mobility. Because and frankly, the digital age provides ever more mobility. So it's humorous to hear Eric Adams, the mayor of New York City, offer this at a press conference yesterday.
Unbelievable.
And we are going to loudly show our support and say to those who are living in Florida, listen, we want you here in New York. You know, we want you right here in New York City. And it's more than just saying that. It's also standing up and aligning ourselves with the men and women of the LGBTQ plus community and stating that we are in unison with you and your right to have self-identification, your right to be live the lifestyle and live the lives that you choose to live without any form of harassment.
Mm-hmm. Just when I thought the real estate market in Florida couldn't get any hotter. Thanks, Mayor Adams.
Thanks.
Absolutely. If you want to live, if you want to base the residency you choose, the state you choose to reside in, based on opposition to legislation that prohibits teaching gender ideology from pre-K through third grade, then please move to New York. And I'm sure a lot of Floridians would agree with me. Please move to New York. And then the commonsensical and successful people that have emptied out of Manhattan will continue to move to Florida.
We got a text message, 64636, type in DA. Except, guys, a lot of New Yorkers are taking over Nashville now.
Well, again, you know, you have to go beyond the license plate because it's like people from Illinois moving to Florida. You know, those are big states with a lot of commonsensical people. They're outnumbered. And so they're fleeing to places like our listener who wrote us fled to, where they can be around like-minded people and live a much more pleasant life at a lower price point. That's happening, too. And in point of fact, in Florida, it was just last year, for the first time ever, there were more registered Republicans than Democrats. Florida's getting redder as the migration increases.
Good.
And, hey, Godspeed. You love it in Chicago. You want to buy the Chamber of Commerce pitch from Mayor Triple Threat or Mayor Adams? Go to it. We won't miss you in the red states.
But it's like pitting Americans against each other.
No, it's not. It's just the kind of life you want to lead. I don't have to, you don't have to be against anybody. It's just exactly what our listener wrote us. We have a better life. People are positive here in Tennessee. People are bleak in Illinois. It's more fun. It's more fun to be in a pleasant, convenient, friendly place.
Have you tried? I mean, nobody says hi to anybody here. Every day I try to be nice to people. And
you want to, you wanted to live in a dystopia. Go ahead. You want to destroy a great city like Chicago? Well, you've done it.
Yeah, congratulations. You won.
So, yeah. I mean, for a long time, I was a lash to the mask guy. But then what exactly is the point? What is the honor in that? I don't get it. It doesn't make sense to me anymore. You know, you've only got so much time on this earth. Do you want to spend it beating your head against bags of cement? Even the people on your side in Illinois, for the most part, aren't really on your side. I mean, you know, when you're talking about the political arena. So what do you got?
Text message, my nephew now lives in Kentucky, working remotely for a Chicago company. Yeah, no one ever has to go back to the office. Oh, and today Mayor Lightfoot going to Google as they welcome back employees for the first time since the pandemic broke.
A buddy of mine texted me from that he's got a friend in Bridgeport who's like really active in the Bridgeport neighborhood. He guy goes to his local coffee shop and everybody there's wearing a mask.
It's cool. Everyone's wearing masks. They're walking down the street. They're never. This mindset is not going to go away.
So do you want to be around that?
No.
Or do you want to say, you know, every COVIDian cultist, come to Chicago. We'll take your spot in Florida, Arizona, Tennessee, the Carolinas, Texas. No problem.
But I'll tell you, Dan, if you told me back in May of 2019 that employees would first go back to work on April 5th of 2022, I would have had a heart attack. So I'm glad I didn't know that.
Yeah, because that's a slow bleed. That's how they do it. It's a slow boil.
And they're offering them scooters. If they come to work today, you can be greeted by the mayor and you get a free scooter because they're desperate to have people come back downtown because downtown is dead. But they did that to themselves.
They're desperate again. They're always desperate. They're not desperate. You need to remove that phrase from your vocabulary.
I know, you've told me that earlier.
They're always desperate because they're so earnest about doing the right thing. No, they're not.
No, I just meant, you know, handing scooters out.
Yeah.
To employees. Come back, please.
They've got another scam that they're unfurling today.
All right.
Is what's happening.
The scooter scam at Google.
Phil and Darian. Hey, Phil.
Dan, to strengthen your point, Dan, and Amy, earlier you said, if they were to lock us down again, that you wouldn't comply. Well, Amy, here's the fact. The fact is, you would comply because nobody wants to be singled out. If we haven't learned anything at all, these last 2 years have been a big social experiment. You see how easy it is to get the law-abiding citizens that don't want trouble to do what they're told. So, Dan, to strengthen your point, Red people just need to be near red people so you don't have to be singled out. And blue people just need to be with blue people. There wouldn't be any trouble, you see? Then they can teach their kids whatever they want. There's not going to be any opposition. And this is my point.
Thanks for the call, Phil.
Yeah,
I mean,
talk about anal sex in kindergarten. Yeah, that's good.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, it makes life perhaps a little bit less dynamic. And that's unfortunate because I like living in Chicago for much of the time that I was there, even though I was vastly outnumbered. I'm all for, you know, spirited discourse and a good intellectual fight. But I mean, I'm not trying to be William Wallace. Who is? What, at this point in Chicago, like to lash yourself to the mass is to say, I want to be martyred. For what? Karen and Beecher.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to tell you about my son who moved to Georgia. I've talked to you about my son before. He was all in Chicago for 3 years, tried everything, worked to do financial literacy for the homeless, joined all sorts of different athletic clubs, tried to participate in everything that he could, but he kept getting shunned and shut out because nobody accepted his natural immunity. So he moved to Georgia, and lo and behold, he's flourishing. He was actually literally, figuratively dying on the vine in Chicago. But in Georgia now, he is flourishing. He's found a beautiful, awesome church. He started dating women without an agenda. And so, yeah, just proved your point.
I don't know. You better be careful.
My damn prof is single.
Women without an agenda. As if there is such a thing. thanks for the call, Karen, though. I appreciate it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Georgia's another state. Yeah. Although that's, you know, to some extent, I think it's perceived to be more in competition than it actually is. But yeah, I mean, if you have a kleptocratic political culture, which these states dominated by urban centers do to varying degrees, Chicago being the worst, then it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time. And if there's no real political pluralism, and is there in Illinois or California or New York or Connecticut, then what do you got? You got a slog, and that's no way to live if you don't have to.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That mannequin who wandered out of the Mishawaka Macy's men's department and
yes.
became mayor of South Bend and now transportation secretary. He is the Carlton Sheets of energy policy. You remember the infomercial pitch man Carlton Sheets, no money down real estate?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So you have no money, you buy a house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How'd that work out for people?
This is what he is selling with respect to energy independence. You have no fossil fuels, and you're energy independent. And not only are you energy independent, energy's free.
So less dependent on foreign oil, and that protects us from shortages at fuel stations. But here's the thing to remember. Even if all of the oil we use in the USA were made in the USA, the price of it is still subject to powers and dynamics outside of the USA, which means that until we achieve a form of energy independence that is based on clean energy created here at home, American citizens will still be vulnerable to wild price hikes like we're seeing right now.
Right. Markets exist. We understand that. And so prices are dynamic. But they wouldn't be dynamic in the woozy dream world of Mayor Pete and these Green New Dealers who want to run a $20 trillion economy on windmills and switchgrass. You want to look at the cost per wattage hour of these green energy options versus fossil fuels at present. I just love, we have a cost here. And what I'm proposing is without cost. And that's a lie. For more on this, these Econ 101 lessons we must do so you can do them within your friend circles, because so many people are economically illiterate. We're pleased to be joined by Jim Pinkerton, co-chair of the Rate Coalition and contributor to the American Conservative and Breitbart. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, you know, just because we release some oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, Jim, doesn't mean that we're not going to be subject to, and just because we would offer drilling rights on public land or restart the Keystone XL pipeline or any of the things that would make us energy independent, primarily relying on fossil fuels, doesn't mean that we wouldn't face higher gas prices at some point in the indeterminate future. So why not go headlong into a Tesla in every garage and a windmill in every backyard and a solar panel on every roof right now?
Well, sure. Everybody should buy a Tesla for $80,000. That's the obvious solution, as Secretary Buttigieg has said, apparently in earnest, many times.
And the Biden administration doesn't seem to be taking such a hard line as Mayor Pete there, because Biden is essentially at least presenting rhetorically the all of the above approach to trying to reduce the price at the pump.
Well, he is. But as I wrote in my Breitbart piece that, over the weekend, at the same time, they're still at it. And for example, on March 21st, the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is led by a Biden appointee, a fellow named Gary Gensler, issued a new ruling that said that every publicly traded company has to compute its carbon footprint. And again, this is allegedly to keep the company from being in danger from too many CO2 molecules. It's exactly the sort of Mickey Mouse thing that's going to hire a bunch of lawyers somewhere and then give a talking point to some green, and furthermore set up some shareholder lawsuit down the road where some trial lawyer can say to the company, hey, you violated your rules, blah, blah, blah. In other words, even as Biden is talking a good game and Energy Secretary Granholm is talking a good game about more drilling, they're not doing anything, really, to increase actual production. They're taking stuff out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve may be a good idea. I mean, the reserve was created for a reason, for real emergencies, not for just bad policy as a solution.
Yeah, but it's political. But he said they're going to take it out. And for, I mean, there's the line of bull jive that they said they're going to do this for the next 6 months, why the big greedy oil companies can get up to speed, drilling on federal land.
Well, we'll see. But I mean, the lesson is, again, you know, remember, just up until a month or so ago, that President Biden wanted a woman named Sarah Bloom Raskin as the vice chair of the Federal Reserve, and she had explicitly said that she wanted to use the regulatory power of the Fed to choke off fossil fuel energy production. She sort of took it back in desperation. They did, but she, fortunately, she didn't make it, and so she's not confirmed. Even as she was departing from the Fed nomination, Biden said, "Oh, you're great, Mrs. Raskin, and we're going to want you back somewhere making policy." Biden, because of Ukraine, has a genuine crisis on his hands with energy crisis and gas prices in Europe and so on. And he's sort of talking a good game now about increasing production, but nobody has explained that to what I call the deep green state, which is still, even as we speak now, plotting and scheming to restrict, if not cut off completely, carbon energy.
And you have Ray Dalio, the founder of Bridgewater, which is one of the bigger asset management firms in the world, saying we're going to have a period of stagflation. You have Jamie Dimon, head of America's largest bank, saying the Fed, well, I don't know if he's saying he should or he predicts the Fed will, but he's saying they should raise interest rates higher faster. So more and more analysts are talking about stagflation, talking about recession, and it doesn't seem that the response from the Biden administration is commensurate with the threats before us economically.
Well, of course, that was also true for the president that Biden so much resembled, which is Jimmy Carter, going back to the late 70s. I mean, Carter was helpless in the face of stagflation, and, you know, was a one-termer. And I've written many times that the parallels between Jimmy Carter, the 39th president, and Joe Biden, the 46th president, are overwhelming.
And the response from Republicans, I mean, it seems to be the Republican Party is still a bit divided on whether or not to interrupt an opponent who is melting down or to engage on every front and continue to make their case so that people, the American people, understand the clarity of the choice before them come November.
Yeah, well, one figure who's really trying hard to present the alternative is a Midwesterner, Representative Jim Banks, the chairman of the Republican Study Committee in the House. He's done a great job of just pointing out over and over again how, you know, the one promise that Biden is keeping is the promise to get rid of, as he said in his executive order of January 27th, 2021. I want to phase out fossil fuels, and Representative Banks is quite persuasive. They are even now working on that.
Right, and you have the confusing. I mean, if you just sort of lay things out simply, I think most people who have common sense, and it's most people, will understand how it doesn't make sense. On the one hand, you have the Granholms and the Mayor Pete's talking about eliminating fossil fuels. Biden, once upon a time, although he's tamped that down recently. On the other hand, they're saying we're going to provide more natural gas, fossil fuel generated energy, to Western Europe so they can wean themselves off of Russia's natural gas.
Yeah, they can't decide. I mean, the politics are clear as to people want lower gas prices and you want to help Europe deal with, you know, wean away from Russia. That's obvious. However, the green donors, and I would argue that the green environmentalists, especially the donors, are the strongest single faction within the Democratic Party now. You know, they will have, to this day, never admit there's anything more important than climate change. Not Russia, not China, not anything else, but climate change. And Biden, on March 14th, held the first in-person fundraiser of his presidency. And, you know, he said, began by saying climate change is the, quote, existential threat. And that's the phrase, that's the litmus test that the Greens apply. If you want the Greens to support you, you have to say climate change is, quote, existential, quote, quote, which is to say we'll all die if we don't fix this. And that's what they want to hear, and that's what they demand. And if you find yourself saying that climate change is an existential threat, which is to say it's worse than Russia, worse than China, worse than inflation, worse than street crime, whatever, then you find yourself pretty much where the Biden people are, which is even as you're talking about expanding energy and selling liquid natural gas to Europe, you're still dreaming up ways to restrict it here at home.
Well, and to your point, I mean, on the occasion of Putin's invasion of Ukraine, you had John Kerry just days after our climate czar, term of Russian royalty, which is quite ironic, say that, well, we hope, you know, we're very upset about him invading Ukraine, essentially, he said, but we hope he can, you know, continues to stay engaged to meet his carbon reduction goals. So, yeah, hey, bad Putin, but we're still relying on you to keep your promise about climate change because, you know, you said you take that seriously. This is like a Dr. Strangelove level farce, these people.
Well, and the United Nations, you know, you think that the UN Secretary General will be worried about, you know, war crimes and atrocities in Ukraine and, you know, Ethiopia and wherever else. And instead, he's talking about the new climate change report, the IPCC. And again, you want to ask him, if the Russians keep blowing up Ukrainian cities and starting fires, does that count as CO2 in the atmosphere?
Does that count against their carbon emission commitments? Yes. Right. Yeah, that's the real important piece of it.
But I think the point is that the Greens and the donors and the, you know, the George Soros's and, you know, Lorraine Powell Jobs and all of them are so powerful that they, in a word, bought, you know, the Democratic Party and the United Nations bureaucracy and, you know, much of, you know, the sort of the international establishment. And so even now, in the middle of all those atrocities in, you know, Bucha, Ukraine, and so on, they're still saying, oh, no, climate change is a real issue. And John Kerry is, you know, far and away the worst. They'll take a private jet to explain to you why you need to, you know, lose your job. That seems fair to him. It's not a good situation for the Democrats, but this is what happens when you let your donors tell you what to do.
Yeah, it's weird because John Kerry didn't, you know, there was no pushback when Biden said we're going to start drilling again on federal land.
Remember, the president can say that, and the Sierra Club can sue, and the EPA bureaucrats can slow roll it. I mean, so Biden can get credit for saying it. The 6 months from now or a year from now, let's come back on the air and see whether or not more federal lands actually got drilled. Because as we all know, the easiest thing in the world is for some green activist to get an injunction against or a protest. I mean, the XL pipeline is a great example. The XL pipeline, Biden killed it, but even before it was killed, the protesters were out there doing their best to block it, and we'll see whether they actually manage to actually increase production. I'm skeptical.
He is Jim Pinkerton, co-chair of the Ray Coalition and contributor to the American Conservative and Breitbart. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Dan and Amy, that theme music means it's time for a conversation, weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. But before we do.
Yeah, what's the other theme song?
We've got Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Johnny Van Zandt has composed a ode to Ron DeSantis and Florida. And it goes a little something like this.
Like it already.
The press don't like him, but it sure does get my business. He stands up for what he believes. So don't come down here trying to change things. We're doing all right in the Sunshine State. Say, out of our business, leave our gov alone.
Oh, yeah.
Down in sweet Florida.
Oh, I love it.
Our governor is red, white, and blue. Oh, down in sweet Florida. Straight telling us the truth.
love it.
So what theme music would you come up with for Governor Jelly Belly? I've got one.
Okay.
And you know, it doesn't need to be an original composition. It's already been done.
All right.
And it's a nice twofer, I think.
What is it?
Weird Al Yankovic's I'm Fat. Because it's got the, you know, the obvious. And
right.
then it's also a parody. And we have a governor who's a parody of an executive. See, it works on two levels. What do you think, Ted? Ted Dabrowski joins us.
Well, I think, you know, maybe Leaving on a Jet Plane might be another one by John Denver.
That's not bad.
Maybe a little boring, but I think apropos.
That's not bad.
Yeah, that's
not bad at all. Yeah, the good news, though, if we're going to just regurgitate what we're spoon-fed, is the Illinois General Assembly is getting serious about violent crime in Illinois.
Oh, really?
Big cities and mid-sized cities in particular. You know how I know they're getting serious? Because they've convened a task force.
Oh,
and that's when you know some good stuff is about to happen.
Yeah, task force is what we're really good at in Illinois. Well, it's anywhere, really, right? I think that's the sad part. Look, what they know, what Democrats know, is that they passed a crime bill last year that nobody read until, of course, you know, after it was signed. And it's one of those bills that has helped create increased crime. And they're supposed to be kind of unwinding some of that now, but instead all they're doing is doing a task force to identify best practices and things like that. Well, isn't that what you just passed last year?
Yeah, best practices. I wonder if they'll tackle this. Do you think it's a problem when Illinois police resignations are up 65% year over year as they were in 2021, even outpacing the increase of police resignations nationwide? Best practices would be to keep police on the job, it would seem to me, as sort of a starting point. You need police forces, I think, at least I haven't heard recently, those defund the left Democrat socialists, defund the police Democrat socialists talking much about defunding the police lately.
No, you know, the thing is that my colleague Matt Rosenberg just wrote a piece on this task force, and it's amazing how much our police forces are down. And, you know, it's when you beat up the police like we've done and what that new law does, and it puts even more risk on policemen to be policemen and to do policing, then it's no surprise that these numbers are down. And it's like it's not just Chicago, it's statewide. And, he quotes an example of Champaign where they're advertising for private security firms to do the work between, you know, 8 p.m. and 4 a.m. because they don't have enough policemen to do it.
Well, I mean, and also part of this, you know, bill, that's not an anti-crime bill. I mean, cops now can also lose their state certification of work based on an anonymous complaint. So, I mean, there's so many parts of this bill, and then people just, you know, the legislatures, they just signed it, and I don't even know that they read through the whole thing.
Well, a lot of them, they didn't care. I think it was for them popular to sign it no matter what was in it. And, you know, of course, we found out afterwards. And you know, those are the kind of things that have to be undone. If not, what's fascinating, and you know, we can't call it causation, but we can certainly call it correlation, is just how much crime is up. And, you know, we looked at the numbers. You know, not only have they gone up a lot during this last year, but we went back to 2019 before COVID, and the numbers are dramatic, especially murders. And so it's amazing that they're passing more laws that incarcerate fewer people, police less, and treat criminals as victims. We don't know how to treat criminals as criminals anymore. We treat them as victims, and that's the big problem.
And everybody gets the Willie Horton treatment when they're put on electronic monitoring, when they're released rather than being remanded pending trial, particularly for violent criminals, particularly. But they start out with a weekend furlough.
Well, we covered that as well. We talked about mass incarceration. That keeps being thrown around as one of the problems in Illinois, mass incarceration. But, we ran the numbers, and when you look at overall adult population, it's 0.56% of the population that's in, you know, in jail or prison. It's that's not mass by any means, and so they keep using that excuse. But, you know, the numbers of incarceration have gone down a lot in the last few years. And yet, of course, crime keeps going up. So maybe we're going in the wrong direction. Not maybe.
Yeah,
we're going in the wrong direction.
That's sort of like a Fox Butterfield moment. The rate of incarceration is going down and crime is going up. Maybe it's because we're putting habitual criminals back on the streets. Maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah, and I think it all adds up, right, when you start looking at all the data. And I think, you know, if there's one area where the press does somewhat of a fair job is starting to bring up, highlighting some of these things. Chicago Sun-Times is just reporting on these clearances of murders. And right now, you know, Lightfoot is saying that half of all murders are cleared or, quote, solved. But, you know, if you peel back the onion, you find out, well, no, it's not. A lot of cases are solved because they can't be solved, and so they mark them as solved.
Yeah, it's more
the
like
numbers
a
are far lower.
It's more like a quarter that have actually been cleared.
That's right. And a lot of what's being cleared is from you know, years past. So, that's another problem. So if you don't solve murders, then bad guys are emboldened to keep doing bad things.
Well, Ted, I don't know if you heard, but there's a new gun buyback program that's going to take place this summer. $1 million. Local businesses and philanthropic organizations are donating money to the mayor to have that.
Yeah. Good luck. This is just, another way of spending money, but it makes no sense, right? I think, I think you can make a lot more money with your gun, sadly, in the market than by selling it for $100. So I don't think those are not the kind of programs we need. You know, what we go back to is, do we even understand what the problems are? And I think you guys were talking about it earlier. You know, fatherless homes. You know, we don't have two parent households. We're giving away so much in benefits that people are getting, addicted to that and not getting into the real world and getting jobs. So we're creating our own problems by the policies we're pursuing, and that's just another one.
Well, these problems are real, but of course they pale in comparison to the real news on the crime front, the somber news. A high-end store in Hinsdale, Marcus Lemonis's store, there was a smash and grab. And I mean, it's one thing if it's
it took $30,000.
If it's $800 black men are murdered in Chicago in a year, hey, that's one thing. But a smash and grab in Hinsdale, that's where we have to draw the line.
Yeah, that's where, you know, things are really going wrong then, right?
Yeah, I mean,
well, no,
our Democratic policies
have hit the suburbanites.
Oh no, I listen. Hate has no home here.
Yeah.
Mavens in Hinsdale. All of those ghastly, activewear clad suburban housewives. Hey, now let's get serious.
Yeah, but you got to hear, this is Ava Field. She's the Hinsdale Chamber of Commerce spokeswoman.
To have something like this happen is devastating for all the businesses and the community. It's sad that this type of crime came to Hinsdale, and it just puts everyone on edge.
Oh, they're on edge in Hinsdale. Uh-oh.
I mean, you know, if poor black, brown, white families in the city on edge every day because their children aren't safe in front of their homes, hey, we'll pay lip service to that. But now it's time to get real. Nobody touches Lemonis's stuff in Hinsdale, all right?
Yeah, that's the hypocrisy, and sadly, we've seen the numbers get worse in all the bad places. And it's going to spread, obviously, because we don't stop it. We're in some way promoting it, so don't be surprised when it hits Hinsdale and hits other suburbs.
Yeah, it hit Deerfield, too. That historic Deerfield got hit up 3 times and then 5 times downtown.
I'll tell you, it is so devastating. I mean, did they not see the Black Lives Matter signage?
What was the confusion there?
These Hinsdale housewives, these terrible human beings, they paid at the office. And I'll tell you, if these criminals aren't going to honor the sort of payments of other people's money that these enlightened honkies in Hinsdale have offered up, then I don't know if there's any hope. I feel so horrible for those Hinsdale moms. They're such good people. Why do bad things happen to the good people, the good honkies of Hinsdale, Ted?
I don't know, Dan. That's a tough question.
Yeah.
But Deerfield
or all of these other well-heeled suburbs dominated by the hate has no home here socialists. They're such good people. They tell me that Black Lives Matter. So they do.
Police are looking for two black men who left in a black SUV.
Don't pay attention to the body count. Why start now? We haven't for our entire adult lives. Don't pay attention to the body count in Chicago. Pay attention to my signaling about it. And then this happens. That's the real tragedy.
Yeah, I think this is a real opportunity. You know, we have a primary in June. It's time to hear lots more from the candidates who are running. But this is the real opportunity to nail the whole system. I don't know if they can, but again, this is the big opportunity to call criminals out as criminals, not as victims, and to get back to policing, get back to funding the police, and of course, make the police feel like we have their back, because if not, this will just continue in Illinois, and it'll just tie back into the flight from Illinois, because it's just one more reason to leave.
I don't know. There's got to be some sort of wealth transfer we can do here, or move the Hinsdale police, the Deerfield police, down to Chicago. I mean, I just feel like one more extortion payment to the party to which they affiliate should probably do it. Probably keep those businesses safe. The businesses devastated. The people that are on edge in Hinsdale. My heart bleeds for them, Ted, because I'm an empathetic sort.
Well, that's in the crime bill, Dan. You want more transfer payments? It's there. You know, in addition to what we just talked about, the task force. But there's more money for more groups. Same old thing they've been trying for a while.
And I understand some of the Democrat socialists. You know, the den of thieves it is down there in Springfield. They're trying to get more of the funny money from the feds pushed back to the municipalities. Is that a good idea?
Well, back to Muni. Yeah, they want more money. Munis want more money. Everybody wants more money, and they're handing out more money, as we saw. They want to give more tax cuts through this EITC, earned income tax credit. We're not learning our lesson in Illinois, and I think it kind of just plays out to what you were talking about earlier today, that the migration is going to continue because we keep doing the same failed things in Illinois that keep getting us in trouble. You know, more debt, higher taxes, more people leave, more debt, higher taxes, people leave. It's we're stuck in a cycle here, and it's the same old things. There's just more money today because of the bailouts. So they're still handing it out.
Well, I just hope again. I mean, not to beat this drum, but I would hate for these betters or superiors in Hinsdale and River Forest on the North Shore to have to live one day, even one day, like residents of the South and West Sides of Chicago live every day. Wouldn't that be terrible?
Ted Dabrowski,
yeah, you don't have to. That's a rhetorical point.
It's a rhetorical question.
You don't have to respond to that. You don't have to respond to my sarcastic cynicism. Ted Dabrowski, president, WirePoints, WirePoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Thanks, Ted.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Is there a more unctuous politician than Cory Booker? I challenge you to identify a more treacly gas bag in politics than Cory Booker.
Well, he's still grieving, you know, the breakup with his girlfriend.
I understand why Rosario Dawson couldn't continue pretending to be his girlfriend.
Yeah, I mean,
I completely understand. This yesterday at the as the confirmation proceedings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson proceeded.
This is in honor of Maya Angelou and the next Supreme Court Justice of the United States of America. Happy birthday, Maya, Dr. Angelou. You may try to write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me down in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I rise.
Oh, God.
Rise, Sister Jackson. Rise, Judge Jackson. All the way to the highest court in the land. And when we have that final vote, I will rejoice. Ancestors will rejoice. And we will say, Lord, this is a day that you have made. Thank you.
No, thank you, Senator Booker.
Wow, Spartacus needs attention again, huh?
Did he get, like, hit in the head by a UCLA linebacker back when he was tight end for Stanford or something? Is that what happened to him? This guy. And as if that's not bad enough, you have to hear from one of the dumbest, most inarticulate people, not just in politics, but in the Western world. Her name is Mazie Hirono. And for some reason, she thought it was a good idea for her to take up the charge leveled against Democrat socialists that they have a little bit of a double standard when it comes to identitarian politics. Ketanji Brown Jackson, they're going to make history when there was an opportunity to confirm a Republican nominated judge for the D.C. appellate court named Janice Rogers Brown, black female. They chose not to. They vehemently opposed her. Mazie Hirono tries her best to socialist explain this to us.
And I just want to mention, we have said many times that Judge Jackson is in the mainstream. And I want to mention a nominee who has been brought up by Republicans as someone we should have supported. I take it because she was black. And this person, again, her name was brought up several times by Republican colleagues today, Janice Rogers Brown, a black nominee. And apparently that it was for the proposition that the Democrats had a chance to support this judge because she's black, because they seem to be making the argument that that's why we Democrats are supporting Judge Jackson, not because Judge Jackson is so eminently qualified. I looked up some things that Janice Rogers Brown noted, and she gave a speech in the early 2000s when Democrats opposed her nomination, and it was because of her extreme ideology, because she wasn't in the mainstream. For example, in this speech that I'm referring to, before the Federalist Society, she railed against the role of government, claiming that government results in war in the streets, this is direct quoting, and families under siege, among other, I would say rather incendiary and extremist views. It was this extreme ideology that led to widespread opposition to Janice Rogers Brown's.
Yeah. You know how you know if somebody's an extremist or in the mainstream? Mazie Hirono tells you. That's how you know. Janice Rogers Brown ultimately was confirmed, and she served 12 distinguished years on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, the same circuit Ketanji Brown Jackson, without controversy, because you know there was no political hay to make anymore. She had been seated, and then she went about the continuation of her judicial career. She was eminently qualified. She's an extremely thoughtful person. And we're not saying, Republicans, that Democrats are supporting Ketanji Brown Jackson because she's a black female. You're saying it. You're saying it. Your president nominated her based on the litmus test that he articulated, not that Republicans did. And then you have, on the other side, reporting from that Manu Raju, the chief congressional correspondent for CNN.
Right.
he reports breathlessly that Tim Scott, senator from South Carolina, is a no, capital N-O on KBJ. And he's incredulous. Of course he's incredulous, because like Mazie Hirono and the other Democrat socialists in office and his Democrat socialist colleagues in the D.C. press corps, they can't imagine that a black senator would set aside KBJ's race and focus on her professional record and her judicial philosophy as the basis to make a decision whether to vote to confirm or not. If only these Republican impersonators like Romney, Collins, and Murkowski were so resistant to identitarian politics as Tim Scott is. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by David Harsanyi, who is a senior editor for National Review. And David, thanks for joining us. Tell us what's I don't have it in front of me. Sorry. Tell us what your latest book is again.
It's called Eurotrash, Why Americans Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent.
Well, you're not getting through to Maisie Hirano or Cory Booker.
Sorry to tell you this.
I'm triggered. First it was Cory Booker, then Maisie Hirano. There's only so much I can take.
It's punishing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, she is so dumb, and she's always been dumb. I mean, during the Kavanaugh hearing, she literally said that the idea of finding someone guilty before you have evidence is fine. She's just ridiculous.
Well,
she say that?
Yeah.
I forgot the quote, but.
Well, you know, I mean, she's just applying the college campus standard to making that the law of the land or the protocol of the land, if you will. I mean, set aside these constitutional hurdles. But of course, as expected, maybe not with three Republicans, but it's not that much of a surprise either. KBJ will be confirmed and then will be done at least temporarily with these histrionics.
I mean, KBJ was asked questions about her record. Now, what you know, perhaps some of it was unfair or not. I don't have much to say on that. But I do have to point out that Kavanaugh was asked about things that had nothing to do with his record, as was, frankly, Coney Barrett as well, in a way. I mean, about her life and her kids and things like that. I just don't even see the comparison here.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean. He had to pull out his desk calendar from high school or from Yale Law School
High school was high school too.
No, it was high school, wasn't it? Yeah,
high school right. And then college too.
Sure.
I mean, Kamala Harris accused him. I mean, put into the record accusations of gang rape. The two can be even compared is ridiculous. I mean, KBG was treated with respect. I mean, you're allowed to ask her about her decisions on child, you know, pornography cases. It's not out of bounds, and you can bet they would be asking those questions.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get your take on a cultural matter, and that's this escalation of the fight over the parents' rights law in Florida with Disney. Ratcheting up the rhetoric against DeSantis, as well as, of course, other politicians joining in, Disney providing the cover. The heiress to the Disney empire sort of castigating people like DeSantis and supporters of DeSantis and Chris Rufo and anybody who would question Disney's decision on this front, even though Disney was questioning its decision as to what to do for a long time before they were sort of pressed into this. If you think that this is an opportunity for Republicans yet again to emulate the approach that DeSantis is taking, and you want to put this front and center in the 2022 election cycle, well, let's do it. Let's make this a part of the larger conversation about curriculum that was ratcheted up by Terry McAuliffe in Virginia last year.
Well, I mean, there's a lot there. I think yes is the answer to the question that this is an issue. I think that most when you take so-called don't say gay law and you literally read people the text of it, the two sentences, I think, that make up this the part that's controversial, supposedly. You have, I think, like 60% of voters approve. It's the euphemisms and lies, like don't say gay, that make, you know, if you ask them in those terms, they're against it. But that's not what the bill is about, as you know. So I think it's a good issue in the end if you can get through to people and explain to them what it's really about. The Disney part of this, obviously, you know, no one was talking about Disney until Disney got involved in the bill. And you'll notice all of a sudden liberals have no problem leaning on big corporations to do their work. They don't, you know, no Citizens United talk anymore. You know, they just, they want to, in a very, I'm not saying they're like Nazis or anything, but in a very fascistic way, have corporations decide what, you know, in league with government, what people are allowed to say, federal government. I mean, and talk about in schools. They trap your kids. They don't give that you parents any choice. And then they want to brainwash your kids in ways that they, you know, uncultural ideas that you don't want kids learning about. I mean, I think it's a great issue for Republicans, as long as they have the right people sort of getting their message through.
Yeah. And you know, doing sex ed, I mean, we had sex ed in sixth, seventh grade. Starting it in kindergarten is ridiculous because that's what our kids went through with CPS a few years ago.
Yeah.
Well, not now, yeah, it's kids like 10 should years learn, ago, but...
Yeah, kids should learn about this stuff the right way on the playground and through, you know, innuendo and movies.
They should learn by.
I mean, they should learn. They should learn from their parents or however their parents decide. Yeah.
Yes. Right. Yeah, you learn to be ashamed of your body from your parents. I mean, that's exactly how you learn. So this is great, though, too. Now, DeSantis's response, this is why DeSantis is such a pleasure, is because he's willing to stand in the arena and go toe-to-toe with Disney. And the D.C. Press Corps, by extension, which is, of course, rallying around Disney. Jonathan Chait's piece at New York Magazine. DeSantis's threat to Disney is what post-Trump authoritarianism looks like. Because... DeSantis said that, you know, Disney is wrong to move to try to repeal this law, and it's not going to happen anyway. And because he raised the specter of sort of this special legislation that allowed Disney to be essentially a municipality unto itself in Florida is something that he has questions about because it looks like a special deal for a corporation. And we need to get away from special deals and special laws for big corporations or special interests. That's authoritarianism, according to Jonathan Chait.
Everything is anytime Democrats don't get their way, it's authoritarianism to Jonathan Chait. It reminds me of like Woody Allen in Annie Hall, where anytime anyone disagrees with him, it's anti-Semitism. You know,
right.
It's like he can't. If people vote, people voted for DeSantis. People voted for the people who passed the so-called Don't Say Gay bill. I shouldn't even say that, the parental rights bill. And they instituted it. I mean, so now it's authoritarian for the governor to say that a major corporation post-law, you know, is trying to undermine the will of the people. It doesn't even make any sense. They cannot, through their prism, anything they don't get is authoritarianism. Every election they don't win is stolen. You know, everyone is a fascist and so on. You can't have, it's untenable to have this kind of, you know, these two systems where they get whatever they want, no matter how they get it. And Republicans can't even use the same mechanisms of democracy that liberals use in Maryland and in Illinois and New York, right? So, I don't know how we move forward like this for forever.
What was your reaction to the news yesterday that Elon Musk became the largest shareholder in Twitter? I mean, there's some that are guardedly optimistic about his use of his position to add some weight to his opinions about Twitter on Twitter. And then there are others who are like, you know, have gone completely enthralled and are suggesting that Elon Musk is going to save Western civilization for us.
I don't think he will do that. And we shouldn't expect that he should do that. I don't think it's that important. But I mean, if he can change the culture even a little bit at Twitter, where voices are constantly banned and free expression is not allowed. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying it's undermines the First Amendment, but it does undermine the important principle of open, you know, discourse, etc. That would be great, but I'm a little skeptical that he's going to make huge changes there. But maybe I'm wrong. I've had a big change of heart about him because I used to not like him because he relies on government subsidies so much. But lately, you know, he's been, I think, one of the more interesting characters. I never understand why billionaires just don't speak their mind or why they care. And he seems to not care that much anymore. So I've become more of a fan.
I'm in that camp. So we started this at the beginning of the show. See if you want to add. One of the things we thought maybe he could do just to start exercising his influence is come up with a list of prisoners to be released from the Twitter gulag.
Such as
all those people who have been banned. Amy misses Trump's tweets, so
yes,
she offered
Trump back.
She offered the former president. I offered Alex Berenson to be unbanned. You know, where we're trying to compile a list that we'll tweet at Elon Musk and see if he picks it up and runs with it. Anybody you miss from Twitter?
I can't think of anyone offhand. I would take anyone who hasn't threatened someone with violence out of Twitter jail. I think you can curate your own experience anyway. So I don't understand banning people at all. Certainly not the former president of the United States.
Right.
I think should have be able
Putin's
to speak.
Twitter.
Yeah,
there are dictators that are on
Mueller,
Twitter.
Yeah.
Right, dictators are on Twitter, but he's not. Somebody texted in, Dan, free the Babylon Bee. I didn't know that they were.
They were suspended. Yeah,
oh,
definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, but no, that's legit. Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, and the Harsanyi standard for Twitter, I think, is something we can tweet at Elon as well. All right, he's David Harsanyi, senior writer for National Review. The book, Eurotrash, Why America Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent. David, thanks as always.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Your thoughts for Elon Musk's opening statement at his first board meeting at Twitter. A couple of texts, sort of interesting. 847, text from 847, he could break out a copy of Animal Farm. He'd have to read it for the other board members, I presume, but and ask each of the board members to identify which animal they are in the story. That's not bad. I like that. Here's a real insurgent play. Best thing Musk could do? A no-repeal lifetime ban of anyone who at any time on any subject has ever expressed an opinion that could be construed as right of center. And then poof, the American right would never again have to spend our days begging 20-something Twitter twits to please, please let us speak. Destroy the platform from within. Now, I don't know what that would do to the ROI and his $4 billion investment in Twitter, but what's $4 billion to Elon Musk? Rather than trying to make Twitter live up to its original stated mission, make Twitter pay for what it's become. What do you think about that?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I want him to say anyone who's been banned from Twitter, we are welcoming them back right now.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous to silence certain voices.
Well, why? What about what I just offered? Why don't you like that? What about blowing up the platform altogether? If you purge anybody who has a center-right view on anything or ever did, then it becomes a narrow echo chamber like, say, the D.C. press corps, and maybe fewer people would pay attention, and its outsized influence in our discourse would be diminished. You know, think a little bit counterintuitively for a minute.
I'm selfish. I don't want Twitter to go away for a second.
Okay. It's too big. It's become too big a part of your life.
Yeah, it has been. And I'm on vacation next week, and I'm trying to decide whether or not I should take a Twitter vacation.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing. To this texter's point, remember who you're dealing with. So unless Elon Musk is able to reconstitute the entire senior leadership of Twitter, how long can you hold them at bay? It's sort of like, I mean, the argument would go, it's sort of like, you know, making me the board chairman of the Chicago public school system.
Well, that would be fun.
Okay. So, or even the mayor.
Yeah,
where I get to a point, how about you make me the mayor and I get to appoint Chicago Public School board members and tell them what to do, like every other mayor has.
Right.
Okay, but am I really in control of the Chicago Public Schools, or is it not the teachers' unions? Well, the teacher union and all the teachers and administrators that are the predominant number who are dyed-in-the-wool Marxists. So how long can I keep them at bay? How long can I devote all my attention to trying to reconstitute, or more to the point, which I would do, break up that school system? Elon Musk has a lot of interests. How much mind share and money is he going to devote to reconstituting Twitter from the top down or the bottom up, either way? So even if he were to accounts reactivated, Trump, Alex Berenson, Babylon Bee, whoever, you're one person in an institution that is completely allied against you. And it's, you know, this is not the Constitution. This is just a social media platform. You know, all you would be doing is essentially taking the position that they've taken, the culture that they've instituted, to its logical, albeit absurd, end. And in so doing, you would teach them all a lesson, not just in terms of somebody comes along and they make you feel the consequences of the position you've taken and the behavior you've exhibited, but you'd also wreck them financially. All those Twitter twits that the texter references who are of two minds because their 401ks got a nice bump yesterday with an Elon Musk announcement, but they hate Elon Musk and they hate free speech. So what are you trying to save?
312.
Interesting thought.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick message.
Mark Dice is a YouTuber I mentioned, and he does some man on the street stuff to, again, demonstrate the absurdity of so many of these lobotomized leftist views on things. Very much like Penn and Teller. You remember Penn and Teller? They had a show on Showtime called Bull Jive. It wasn't called Bull Jive, though. You get the picture. And one of the things they would do is these petition circulation gags. For example, they circulated a petition to end women's suffrage. And, you know, showed woman after woman signing the petition to end women's suffrage because what do they think? End women's suffering. They didn't know that suffrage meant the vote because, you know, they're ignorant. And one exchange I remember in particular was, I think it was Penn explaining, you know, we're circulating this petition to end women's suffrage. We like to sign. So women's suffrage, and the woman goes, yeah, I know what women's suffrage is. And then she dutifully signs the petition. Why not make people account, feel the repercussions of their ignorance? Wouldn't that be the best example you could provide? We lived before Twitter. We will live if Twitter goes away. We had productive discourse, arguably more productive discourse before Twitter. Perhaps we would have more productive discourse after it. And I'm not just limiting it to Twitter, but I'm using this as an example because of the infusion of Elon Musk. Here's Mark Dice asking people to sign a petition to, I guess, get whoever Tucker Carlson uses as his cell carrier to turn off Tucker Carlson's phone.
As I'm sure you saw, Twitter has banned a lot of people for hate speech, but these people are still able to talk on the phone with their friends and send text messages. So we're going to start by having Tucker Carlson's phone shut off for violating the hate speech policies, and that way he won't be able to talk to his producers or his family or his friends.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you for supporting that.
You're welcome.
He refers to the undocumented immigrants as illegal aliens. Okay, so we're trying to have his phone shut off. print, birth date, and a signature. Thank you for supporting that.
Yeah, thanks for being out here and doing it.
This is the next step in trying to silence these people because, you know, we're getting them off social media, but if they still have a phone, you know, so we're going to shut the phones off.
All for it.
Thank you so much.
All for it.
Yeah, just real quick, birth date, signature. He's doubting Dr. Fauci and, you know, causing a lot of people to question things. So we're going to have his phone shut off.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you for supporting
me. Shut the line up.
He's saying things like Black Lives Matter is a violent movement or has committed violence. And I mean, should people really be allowed to say such things like that today?
No.
Absolutely not.
No.
Thank you for supporting. It just tarnishes the Black Lives Matter image. So thank you for supporting that.
Oh,
why should Tucker Carlson be able to talk on the phone with his producers or his friends about them, right?
Totally agree.
So we're going to have his phone shut off.
I love that.
All right.
Love
thank
that.
You for your support. So shutting off his phone is really the next step to help stop that.
Thank you
for supporting.
Those
turning
kids?
Off his phone is probably the best way to stop him.
Hate him, so
yeah.
That's all. There you go.
I mean, just think about all the people that he speaks to on the phone and all his producers organizing his show. And if we can shut off his phone and silence him that way, that'll be the next step in completing the New World Order. So thank you for supporting that. I guess the technical term is bricking the phone. And there were a lot of discussions to do that to Trump officials, but they never did. So we're gonna apply some pressure.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
I'm not sure what he thinks gives him the right to say such things in today's society. So we're going to have his phone shut off so he can't talk to anybody.
Yeah. And it's young to not so young adults that you can watch in the video sign the petition. I mean, is that a representative sample of America? I don't know. Is it a representative sample of the left? Is it a representative sample of the Twitter engineers? Lee and Hammond.
Hey, guys. You know, I got a lifetime ban off of Facebook years ago.
What'd you do?
As far as this Twitter, I don't know. I'll tell you the truth, I really don't even know. But, you know.
You know.
I don't need
come on.
You know what you did.
You know what you did. Yep.
And I think we ought to just. Let it just dry up and blow away. Don't even use it. It's a muzzle. It's an electronic muzzle. That's all it is.
All right, thanks,
so you don't
Lee.
Follow me on Twitter?
Yeah. Lee's got better things to do.
Too soon?
Greg and McHenry. Yeah, Amy's trying to jump her followers. Greg and McHenry.
Yes, if Elon Musk just, you know, made it go away, made Twitter go away, then we'd have one less soldier in our army. Of trying to, they'd have to knock down every one of these platforms from the inside.
Okay.
And I think it's better to have a soldier in the army in the fight than to just make it go away.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Greg. Yeah. I guess the question is the institution fundamentally incapable? I think the Chicago Public School System is the perfect analogy because you have to ask, is the institution capable of producing what you want it to produce? CPS is not capable in its current organization of educating kids. It's not its priority. Twitter is not capable of being a free speech platform because that's not the corporate culture. That's not its purpose. That's not its mission as defined by those in charge. So Elon Musk can turn all that around, rehabilitate it. Dave and Racine.
Yes, how about having the Twitter fascists be subject to their own rules? You know, if a person spreads disinformation, a Twitter employee, by barring someone who should not be barred, have them permanently barred from Twitter.
Yeah, well, then we're starting from their premise of their censorious premise. Then we're becoming them. And what are we reminded to do? By me. We're not them. We don't want to become them. We could be them, but we don't want to be them. We should guard that distinction jealously. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.